We're talking about the move to unionize, a first for a major video game company, and the Wisconsin Connection on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So these are quality assurance workers at Middleton-based Raven Software, which is a subsidiary of the parent company Activision Blizzard. And they work on the video game Call of Duty. Join in on workers organizing in the video game and tech industries. What this signals to you, 800-642-1234. Jessica Gonzalez is a Los Angeles-based organizer for the Communication Workers of America Labor Union. She's a former quality assurance tester for several gaming companies, most recently Activision Blizzard. Jessica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Good morning. So until late last year, you had spent 7 years as a quality assurance tester of video games, and that could sound like a dream job for a lot of people who love gaming. What is that job really like?
Yeah, so quality assurance is, for one, a great discipline. It is the kind of last line of defense that your software is going to hit before it hits the consumer. So the quality assurance team, they are tasked with essentially trying to reverse engineer the product, making sure that, you know, there aren't any groundbreaking bugs that's going to stop the game from being playable, just making sure that anything, you know, new added into the game didn't break anything else upon introduction. And yeah, it really is just scrubbing all corners of a game and making sure that it's as polished as possible, especially for a title like Call of Duty that's such a large, you know, known title. So there's obviously an expectation of quality there. Mm-hmm. So quality assurance tester's job is to ensure the quality of the product.
What about the pay? What about the hours?
Yeah, absolutely. So quality assurance is kind of notoriously underpaid and undervalued in the video game industry. I actually went from video games to tech for a little bit. And, you know, there is a little bit of a pay bump there. Not sure why games is a little bit behind in that regard, but it is something that I'm looking into trying to fix because it is a technical job. But yeah, compensation wise, you know, quality assurance testers starting Activision were making below minimum, you know, which is obviously strange. And then the hours along with that, there's almost like a mandatory overtime that is required for this job. I remember when I started at Activision, I was doing up to 14-hour shifts a day.
Wow. And there's also this period of time called crunch time when there is a launch or an iteration of a game. Is that right? And where the hours get really intense.
Yeah. So crunch is almost inevitable in software development. So crunch time is when, you know, you have this milestone you're trying to reach and there's not enough, you know, work in the product that's supposed to meet the milestone. So we're essentially crunching to meet the milestone. So it's kind of just like an all hands on deck. Everybody's, you know, working as soon as the work is readily available. And so that can range anywhere from, you know, your normal 8-hour shift. A lot of times, oftentimes it goes from 12 to 14 hours. I remembered my first job as a quality assurance tester. I was working on Call of Duty Black Ops 3 in Activision. And I was actually working night shift, but we were working 12 to 14 hour shifts a day, up to 6 days a week.
And this is not remote work. You were working at the company, I would imagine, company headquarters.
That's right. Yeah. So we would be working in office and night shift and day shift shared stations. So as we would be clocking out, day shift would be going in. So it's kind of like almost like a 24-hour on the clock job.
Mm-hmm. Why did you leave the company?
Yeah, great question. So I left the company in December of last year. I actually worked at Blizzard before leaving. I was a senior test analyst, which is their fancy title for quality assurance tester, who's been around for a long time. And yeah, so I left the company. I was receiving a lot of like internal pushback for kind of organizing. I was really championing our diversity and inclusion committees. You know, after the Department of California Fair and Employment and Housing sued Activision Blizzard for sexual harassment and discrimination, I became kind of an activist in that, you know, I've obviously wanted to be part of the change in the company. So that kind of put a little bit of a target on my back in regards to like being public and talking about issues, working conditions, et cetera. So, you know, I was getting a lot of pushback internally. People were kind of watching my social media. People were kind of like campaigning against me. It was a very interesting time for sure. So I decided it was a little too much pressure for me. So I decided to take a step back from actually working at the company and then continuing my organization work with Communication Workers of America.
And we're going to talk about that organizing work here in just a moment. I'm going to reintroduce you, Jessica Gonzalez, former video game tester, now organizing people in the gaming industry to improve working conditions. You can join in on unionizing 800-642-1234 in the video game industry, in the tech sector. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. So, Jessica, about last week, 19 of 22 quality assurance testers for Raven Software, vote to form a union called the Game Workers Alliance, Raven being out of a Madison suburb of Middleton. Can you explain, how did you help organize the workers there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was already kind of doing organizing work through A Better ABK, which is my Twitter handle. A Better ABK was formed when Activision Blizzard responded to the lawsuit. And, you know, the employees felt like they weren't being heard. They weren't being accurately represented. So we decided to make like an employee-led communication network, essentially. So we had been posting about the lawsuit. We had been posting about collective action that was happening under, around all of ABK, which is Activision Blizzard King. And Raven had been watching us already because they are a subsidiary of Activision Blizzard. And, unfortunately in December, they had 12 testers that were kind of blindsided by layoffs after being promised, you know, full-time work, better pay, better benefits, et cetera. So they approached me and said, hey, you know, we noticed you've been organizing. We just had 12 people let go. Can you help us? Hmm. And absolutely, I'm always jumping at the chance to help my colleagues, even if they're in another studio that I've never even been to before. So, this is something that's commonplace in the games industry, is that they'll hire contract testers, promise them a full-time job, and then kind of exhaust, you know, almost like exploitively work them. And then, you know, they get burnt out
or and then once they get laid off. I was going to say, once the contract ends, it's up to that employee to reapply for a new position in the company. Is that how it goes?
That's correct. And also, the contracts weren't even up to end. They just terminated them.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So that can happen.
So what does this mean? You know, in Wisconsin here, we have Act 10, we're a right to work state. We've seen unions, very much union membership, diminish over the decade. How much power can workers expect in a union in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So the Raven Software Union, the Raven Software Quality Assurance Union, is something that was forged through fire. I feel like we fought really hard to get here. We fought against a huge anti-union campaign. Activision Blizzard hired anti-union consultants. One was Wilmer Hale, famously, and then Reed Smith, who was the actual law firm that went to court with the Raven Software QA testers to argue if they were an eligible unit. And then we ultimately won that, which was great. And we also won the election. So it's kind of amazing to see a group of 19 out of, 21 or 22 people vote to unionize when they were really heavily dealing with this anti-union campaign at the same time. So it's kind of amazing. It's amazing to go up against the boss. And I think in a video game industry, it's even more like, you know, there's a huge symbolism there of like a group of quality assurance testers, notoriously undervalued, underpaid, were able to come together and beat the boss. So very exciting. And I think it sets a huge precedent for the rest of the, you know, AAA video game industry and even the games industry as a whole. I think a lot of people are very tired of the labor practices.
But what is the bargaining power for Game Workers Alliance?
It's whatever they make it, honestly, because, you know, at the end of the day, Raven QA testers know what's best for them, and the ability to be able to collectively bargain for their better working conditions, you know, being paid better, more respect, you know, it's just whatever they decide to put at that table. It's going to be leading by example and setting a precedent for the rest of the industry. I want, you know, my goal for this union is to really say this is how we should be treating quality assurance in the video game industry. And, you know, hopefully other studios can kind of take note on that.
Jessica Gonzalez with us, labor union organizer with the Communication Workers of America, formerly working in the area of quality assurance for video game makers, as we were talking about. Join in on working conditions in the gaming industry, questions about unionizing, what this could mean for your work, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jessica Gonzalez here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing working conditions in the video game industry and the recent vote to unionize at Raven Software in Middleton. That's a subsidiary of Activision Blizzard, makers of games like Candy Crush, like Call of Duty. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And last month's vote to unionize by quality assurance workers marks a first for a major gaming company in a nearly $200 billion industry. That worldwide market worth is, according to research firm Mortar Intelligence. Join in on how you feel about the emergence of game worker unions in America. 800-642-1234. Jessica Gonzalez with us, labor union organizer, formerly working in quality assurance for Activision Blizzard, and with us for about 9 more minutes. Jessica, you mentioned this very briefly, that the state of California and the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they sued Activision Blizzard for pervasive gender-based discrimination, like women routinely paid less than men for similar work and fostering a bro culture. Can you explain the ramifications of the settlement?
Absolutely. So Activision Blizzard was sued by the Department of Fair Employment and Housing through California. And this was a 2-year investigation that started, I believe, in 2018 or 2019. And they kind of were calling all of the women at the company to kind of give testimony. And after the 2-year investigation, they decided to, you know, proceed with it. And then it went public. And the response from leadership was, you know, that of denial and not taking accountability. So a lot of the employees expressed concerns with not believing victims. You know, there was still a lot of people that were still working at the company. So we all collectively decided that it was unacceptable to try to ignore a problem in the video game industry. And I think, it translates as well in the gaming industry in general. You know, gaming can be mostly male dominated. Women don't already feel included in the space a lot of the time. So it really was great to see everyone kind of come together collectively and just push for better.
You mentioned the gender balance. What can you tell us about the gender balance in the video game industry? Who are behind these games?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of the executive level, higher level positions are notoriously, you know, male dominated. It really is hard for a woman coming in the space. I feel like, you know, there's obviously a lot of nepotism that happens in the industry. There's a lot of office politics. And unfortunately, you know, there are people who abuse their positions of power, and quality assurance in the games industry is notoriously, like I said, underpaid. And they're kind of kept with like this carrot on a string where they say, you know, work really hard for 6 months and we'll extend your contract, or we'll hire you full time. And then it really does depend on the team you're with or what lead you have, because easily those formulas, you know, can be abused for personal gain by people who have power.
So this settlement, $18 million settlement to compensate employees who experience discrimination, you are appealing the settlement. Can you explain why?
I am, absolutely. So, you know, one of the main reasons why I appealed the settlement is because it's very rushed, in my opinion. To me, it seems like they want the merger with Microsoft to go through. So they wanted a judge to approve on the settlement. The settlement seems woefully inadequate because if you look at Riot Games, who had they were being sued by the same entity, they just settled for $100 million. And even that, I feel like, is a low number. Just think about, you know, this multi-billion dollar industry and all of our labor creates that revenue. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, the decade of abuse and everything that went on for so long, it's kind of, you know, unfortunate that they would put that low of a number to survivors and victims. So I think it's a low amount, and I think it should be more because there's a lot of people affected. And another thing too, is I noticed that if you were to sign on to the EEOC settlement, like if you were to agree to it, they were able to have all of the evidence, and then the DFEH could no longer use that. So I didn't want that to happen. You know, obviously the DFEH has all of my evidence and information there. So I didn't want to forego that. I wanted the representation.
There's this provision that bars people who apply to be claimants from future settlements. Is that an issue?
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate because one of the things that we advocated very largely for when all of this started was the end of all mandatory arbitration clauses in employee contracts, contract or full-time. You know, it's very often that you sign those things because of, you know, the nature of the work. You're working on something that's unreleased. A lot of times, you know, you're bound by a non-disclosure agreement. So people are a little bit afraid. They feel like they can't talk about their working conditions or things that happen to them. And I feel like this is just another way to kind of silence people, which is unfortunate. You know, these issues are very important, and we're not going to tackle them and fix them unless we kind of take accountability for, you know, the decade of, you know, issues here.
Talking with Jessica Gonzalez, former quality assurance tester of video games, most recently for Activision Blizzard, which is the subject of our conversation on unions. She's now an organizer for the Union Communication Workers of America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Communications Workers of America said, Jessica, that workers will soon, in talking about the Game Workers Alliance, that they will soon have an enforceable union contract and a voice on the job. Can you explain what are the next steps here and how this contract will come together?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of the time the employer likes to use a third party, like, you know, to thwart any unionization attempts, but really the union is you and your coworkers. So if you know at the end of the day what's best for your position, you know, like myself, I've been in quality assurance for 7 years. I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of, you know, the working conditions and what we could improve upon. So it really is upon those, you know, that group of QA testers to come collectively, you know, negotiate a contract or design a contract that's going to be in their best interest. And then, you know, then bring that to the employer and say, hey, like we want these conditions. So it really is on them. And the great thing about unions is that they're very democratic. So this process, it could take a long time, but the most important part of it is just everyone aligning on proper treatment in the industry, better working conditions, better benefits, better protections, et cetera. Should they even crunch? Like some people enjoy doing crunch. So it really is about if you choose to crunch, you know, do we have the mental, physical protections? Because I've seen a lot of people suffer through crunch periods.
And you say better working conditions, and that can mean a lot of things. What might be high on the list of demands from the union members?
Yeah, so I can't speak to that because I haven't worked at Ravensoft. I would just say that they would probably know the best interest of their own working conditions. But, you know, I can say at a very minimum, compensation would absolutely need to go up. You know, there's a lot of these game companies are in expensive locations like Irvine, California, very expensive Los Angeles, Santa Monica, you know. Madison's beautiful, by the way. I just visited a couple weeks ago. It's very nice.
Thank you.
yeah, but It is really about having a quality of life and not just kind of surviving for the company and giving, you know, getting burnt out, because a lot of the industry is having exceptional talent and then, you know, exploiting that passion instead of nurturing it. And then it turns into a burnout situation. So, and then you get tired and go to another company. So we obviously want to keep talent. So that's going to be our top priority probably.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me and, you know, giving me a platform to talk about these things. It's really important to me.
Jessica Gonzalez is a former quality assurance tester of video games, most recently for Activision Blizzard. She's now an organizer for the union Communications Workers of America. Ahead this hour, we talk with a Wisconsin physician about how healthcare professionals talk about obesity with patients in the clinic visits and how it could affect the care that patients receive. Join in on obesity conversations with your doctor, 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick note here on the podcast Mapped Out. Legislative redistricting touches almost every area of government and policy, and the fight over it here in Wisconsin has been fierce. WPR has released the final bonus episode of Mapped Out. This is the award-winning podcast that helps you understand redistricting and how it affects you. Listen at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts. Of Wisconsin's 600 historical markers, just 7 commemorate the history of the state's Black and African American residents. The Wisconsin Historical Society is working to change to that by adding about 40 markers recognizing the history of Black and other marginalized communities. As Diane Bazooka reports, one of the first few new markers will highlight a southern Wisconsin lake town that was a safe haven for Black families from across the Midwest.
6 miles east of Lake Geneva is a small subdivision nestled beside a quiet lake, Lake Ivanhoe. Peter Baker first visited in the 1960s. He was 9 years old, and his friend brought him up from Chicago on a fishing trip.
I bet we caught over 70, 100 fish, bluegills and crappies, and it was the most exciting and life-changing thing for me. So we went home, and I ran in the house with all these fish, and I showed my mother. We were up there in Lake Ivanhoe, and it was all Black. And the first thing she said is to my father, Ernest, we're going up there next week.
The Bakers bought a house on Tuskegee Drive and moved the family up from Chicago. During the era of sundown towns where African Americans were not welcome after dark, he says Lake Ivanhoe was a refuge.
This was about as safe as life could get up here. We literally could sit in the middle of the roads at nighttime and watch the stars and talk and play. The freedom was unbelievable.
Baker later learned that was the whole idea when the community was dreamed up a century ago as the first Black-founded development in Wisconsin. In the wake of nationwide race riots, African-American leaders from Chicago bought the land in the 1920s to build a Black resort town. It was an immediate hit, drawing families from across the region and performances at a central pavilion by acts like Cab Calloway. But the stock market crash in 1929 brought it all to an end. Following World War II, families like the Bakers rediscovered Lake Ivanhoe and slowly made it a year-round community. Baker eventually built his own home and raised his family here. Now he's president of the Lake Ivanhoe Homeowners Association.
This is our clubhouse right here. It was a much smaller place.
But he says things have changed. Now, the community is mostly white and Hispanic. African Americans are only about 10% of the population.
The lake needs dredging, the road needs repair, and the history of Lake Ivanhoe is fading.
That's why Baker has been working on getting a historical marker. In recent years, he's been getting help from Katie Green.
Have you ever seen this?
These guys fishing on Lake Ivanhoe?
Yes, ice fishing. Look at this here.
Green has spent summers in Lake Geneva since the 70s, but she had never heard of Lake Ivanhoe until a few years ago when a friend's grandmother mentioned it.
I had asked all my friends that I grew up with in Lake Geneva, I asked all my current neighbors, have you heard of Ivanhoe? Nope, nope, nobody that I knew. So I started to dig into it.
That's how she met Baker. Now she and Baker often spend their Saturdays combing through old documents and newspapers.
Carol and Billy Cross?
They're trying to connect with past residents. One of the people they found was Janet Alexander Davis, who came to Lake Ivanhoe in the 50s on family fishing trips.
One time I caught what they call a dogfish. That was the ugliest fish I've ever seen. Ugly and big. But I was so proud of that fish.
She hasn't been back since childhood, but she's excited about the marker.
It's proof that we were treated differently in this society and continue to be, that we had to find our own way and have our own things because we couldn't just go where we wanted to go, to shop, to live, or to buy. So what I felt there was free.
Baker's planning a dedication ceremony for the new marker. He wants to invite past residents, have a pig roast and big band music, like the old days.
I plan on being here for a long time, hopefully for the rest of my life. And I just hope it's always a place that African Americans can feel safe in. I literally am at peace here.
And he believes recognizing the community is the best way to ensure future generations find refuge there, too. Diane Bazuka, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to obesity and patients not feeling respected by their doctor. According to Kaiser Health News, the Association of American Medical Colleges is set to roll out new diversity, equity, and inclusion standards. One aspect is to teach physicians about respectful treatment of people diagnosed as overweight or obese. Join in on obesity and your doctor visits 800-642-1234. Dr. Srividya Kadambi is an associate professor of medicine and chief of the Division of Endocrinology and Molecular Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Kadambi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. From what I understand, the new DEI standards haven't come out yet, but what do you make of this? What do you think the Association of American Medical Colleges is trying to address about obesity patients and that relationship?
I think it's appropriate time. It should be considered as a core value teaching for the medical students. In many sense, obesity medicine or treatment of patients who suffer from obesity, it really has lagged behind how prevalent obesity is. You hear a lot about teaching about heart disease, diabetes, and various other health conditions. If you think about it, the core really cause of many of these conditions is actually body weight. So we have really lagged behind in teaching medical students how to treat obesity. And one of the important part of treating anything is that teaching the medical students not only the physiology and pathology of any health condition, but how to treat individuals who suffer from the conditions with respect. And it is a give and take. The patients need to trust the providers. And so this is a good time and an important lesson for the students.
I imagine you might be in a tricky spot as a physician. You want that patient to come see you, but if the focus of the visit is all about their weight or that's the perception, then the patient may avoid the doctor's office. They may cancel appointments or try to avoid them because they think about that looming conversation about their weight. So how do you deal with that tension?
Yeah, that's the tightrope that we have to ask. If you ask some patients, they would say, all that the provider talked about during my visit, anything I said, they brought up the weight. But then some patients say, no one ever talked to me about weight, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a tightrope. That's the art of medicine, right? You find the balance. There are some patients who are ready for the conversation and some are not. And, you know, I think it also depends on how you broach the topic. It should not be blame, you know, assigning, right? It's really finding out what it is and really understanding, starting with understanding where the patient is actually is the most important thing. I think that's where many providers might be going wrong, not understanding where the patient is in their journey. You know, the weight, food habits, I mean, many of these are intensely personal. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to come out right at the right moment. And that's why you are the provider, right? So you have to understand that in that conversation, like in any conversation, you don't bring up abruptly things, right? So you have to understand your audience and bring it up in the right moment. You know, respectfully bring up what the, you know, yes, some conditions are solely because of weight, but not everything, right? So I think having that right balance would actually, will make the conversation go smoother. And I have to agree, it is a tightrope that we have to walk, but that's what we are here for.
Is it plausible that physicians do put too much emphasis on a patient being obese or overweight and that has an effect on the care that they get when investigating medical issues or approaching symptoms conversations that the patient brings up?
So I guess I'm biased towards the medical community. I think, as I said, I think it might be sometimes the providers not knowing how to bring up the topic. Hmm. I think in my experience, I mean, there is no ulterior motive. I think it's in the sense to make the patients feel shame or anything like that. I feel like it's just not knowing when to bring up the conversation. Now, you know, sometimes some of the conditions, like for example, you take diabetes. We know 80% of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, will disappear from the world if their weight problems don't exist, right? So I think it depends on where the conversation is coming from. So it might be coming from good place, but not delivered right. So, you know, instead of if the patient comes in with, you know, toe pain and, you know, there's bleeding there, instead of talking about it, if you talk about weight, that doesn't come out right. So I think finding the right timing is absolutely important. And I have to agree, sometimes maybe, the patient's immediate concerns are not addressed and you're going for a bigger picture, which is not right as well. So I think that's why I said, you know, I think it's knowing when to bring up the conversation is extremely important. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other, patients, it's not just patients who suffer from obesity, but also patients with diabetes say the same thing. You know, every time a patient who has diabetes goes to the doctor, if anything comes up, oh, you know, it's from your blood sugar. So I think it does happen. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's, again, you know, sometimes, you know, many times it's probably true, but at the same time, you know, it's not always true. It's not always either your blood sugars or weight. So, you know, I think teaching the medical students, that's the new, hopefully this new initiative where you're actually teaching the medical students and other learners about how to be respectful, how to understand and bring it up. You know, in my opinion, actually understanding the physiology and science actually helps generate respect.
I was going to say, That it sounds like, you know, you're asking questions of the patient, understanding them, having conversation, and all the while getting a bigger sense of what their life is like and also building trust. And that really takes time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, one of the, I mean, this is just my perception as to why it has taken this long for us to reach where we are with other health conditions. One is knowledge about obesity is very, very young. Mm. You know, we have learned a lot in about last 10 years. So, but still a lot more to learn. We really do not know. It's a very complex disease. We do not know the origins. It could be many things like, you know, genetics, mental health issues, upbringing, life events, and physiology, to be honest. So we don't know a whole lot. So when a student is taught about obesity versus diabetes, I'm just giving an example, diabetes starts with an anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology, pancreas, and all that. Whereas obesity education kind of starts with social aspects, activity intake mismatch, and some of the things, you know, that kind of puts onus on, oh, it's all really in the realm of, you know, social and, you know, some of the individual choices realm, as opposed to, you know, the diabetes starts with the really it's something is wrong in your body. Your pancreas is not making enough insulin. I mean, there are some of the science aspects of it that engenders some sort of, you know, like, you know, the biases we have, right? You know, though diabetes is a disease as opposed to obesity, you're really starting at social level. It's not because we just didn't know a lot of physiology and pathology, but I think we know now enough to teach the students, look, it's a lot of it is going on in the body. Why patients cannot lose weight or cannot keep it off. They can lose weight, but cannot keep it off. So I think from that perspective, I think the respect comes for the health condition. Okay. And I think maybe that will generate, removes the biases. The biases come from thinking that, oh, you know, this patient chooses to have weight problems. Nobody does that, right? So I think that's the misperception from the providers. So if only they got up and moved more, they would not have this. But that's not true.
I was just going to say, let's pause right here talking with endocrinologist Vidya Kadambi, who is at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where her research is on obesity, on hypertension and diabetes. Join in on what it's like to talk with your provider about being overweight or obese, how those conversations go about weight loss. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Kadambi here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about weight-based stigma in healthcare, new efforts by the Association of American Medical Colleges to be more inclusive. Dr. Vidya Kadambi is Chief of Endocrinology and Molecular Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Lou now in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Lou. What is on your mind? Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm wondering why, with all these interviews and all these talks, why nutrition is not being put first and foremost. Most doctors, like a lot of us nurses, when you go through the schooling, you're given basic knowledge. Unless you choose that specialty, your interests or your knowledge base remains a lot smaller than if you really looked in depth into what food does to the body. And much like a car, when you put bad gas in, you're going to have a troubled vehicle. When you put bad food in a body, you're going to have issues. And why nutrition isn't being put out there from the doctors to the patients as a first thing to look at, first talk. What are you eating? How much are you moving? These are the things that I hear from other people that the focus is on the illness, which a lot of it can be reversed. Diabetes is reversible. You have to look at the diet.
And so, I want to get Dr. Kadambi in here on the aspect of nutrition and priorities that take that conversation away. Dr. Kadambi.
I agree with you. I think nutrition is very important. So that's where the tight, tightrope walk, right? So I agree with you. Many of the health conditions can be improved by weight loss or improving fitness. But if you start the every visit with that, you know, the patients are not going to like that because we have to really judge where they are in their journey for understanding the basics of their illness, so whichever it may be. So, since we took example as diabetes, but, you know, so again, you know, the readiness of the patient to listen to the provider about these things. And then at the same time, also, there is also difficulty in a 20-minute visits or appointments to kind of go through all of that. You know, for example, you know, I do ask, you know, I do see both patients with diabetes as well as obesity. And I used to blanketly refer patients to nutritionists But I realized that it doesn't really work unless the patient is ready. So I've just started asking, you know, are you ready to receive, you know, you think it's going to be useful? It turns out many of our patients actually know a lot. It's just the implementation that's the issue, right? So there is advice about how to eat and what not to eat, and all of those things are there everywhere. And for patients who are ready to take that step forward in their life. So I think we have to find the right moment with the patient, for the patient.
Lou, thank you for the call. Michael now in Oconomowoc. Michael, I understand you're a physician treating obesity. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo the doctor and the nurse that shared, you know, what we have learned, and I'm a lifestyle medicine as well as internal medicine pediatrician out here, is that food is probably the biggest factor. Most doctors just don't have the understanding. And also there's a lot of confusion, but we do know a healthy whole food plant-based diet, whole grains, unprocessed carbs, legumes, beans, peas, lentils, with fruits, vegetables, without all the extra high fatty meats and animal protein, has been shown to sustain a healthy weight, reverse diabetes and heart disease. But, you know, talking about this is a delicate process. And what I've realized is that sometimes talking about food is more sensitive than talking about somebody's religion or politics. It's very Wow. sensitive and very personal.
Michael, thank you for that. And Michael also brought up pediatrics. And I'm just wondering, Dr. Kadambi, how do you navigate the tension of talking about obesity with young people, with children?
So I'm an adult provider, so I don't see children, but I think it's a very important. So when I see adults, I think I do ask about the family history. Mm-hmm. So there is a genetic component, really genetics that are passed on through genes. And the other is the environment, which is also kind of in the family, right? So we don't know if, you know, the family, the obesity, if it runs in the family, if it's really because of the genes or because of the environment they live in. No, it is it is actually very important to address weight issues in the children. In fact, parents are more likely to make significant changes if it is related to children as opposed to themselves. Right, it's always the case when the children are involved. So I think if the children, when I ask if their children have weight issues, you know, I am an obesity medicine provider, so people do come to talk to me about weight. So I don't have that same problem that some of the other providers, general practitioners have, where bringing up weight could be a sensitive issue when they come in. For me, they come to me for weight management. So I have, somewhat of a permission to discuss about food and all of that from the patient. So I think it's, really bring it up that, you know, if the children are also having, you know, that's one big important reason to make a good changes. And many patients are very receptive to that. They say that they want to lose weight or maintain weight for their children. So, yeah.
Dr. Kadambi, thank you so much for joining us on this issue.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Vidya Kadambi is an associate professor of medicine, chief of the Division of Endocrinology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. For disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead, we explore the unknown and unexplained with the head of the Wisconsin Cryptids, Anomalies, and Paranormal Society. Join in with questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.